The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, where we discuss and dissect documentaries with our guests from the worlds of comedy and film. Today, we are talking with the Tilapia Film team, responsible for making great docs like Rodents of Unusual Size, Everyday Sunshine, The Story of Fishbone, and Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea. And we've got with us the award-winning nonfiction filmmakers Quinn Costello, Chris Metzler, and Jeff Springer, who've traveled all over the world in search of unique stories highlighting important environmental, scientific, and cultural issues. And their work has been at South by Southwest in Tribeca, along with national broadcasts on PBS and the Sundance Channel. Let's everyone introduce yourselves.
I'm Quinn Costello. I'm the co-director and editor for Rodents of Unusual Size.
I'm Chris Metzler. Thanks for having us, George. I'm the co-director and co-producer of Rodents of Unusual Size, and worked with Jeff also on Everyday Sunshine, The Story of Fishbone, and we co-directed Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea.
And I'm Jeff. I'm the third guy. I get another co-director on Rodents of Unusual Size, as well as Plagues and Pleasures, and I worked with Chris on the Fishbone film.
Nice. And am I correct? I was reading a bit. You guys, Jeff and Chris, met at USC Film School. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And
freshman dormitory hall.
Oh, so undergrad. Were you USC undergrads? Okay. I didn't know that there was a film undergrad at USC. I know there's a grad program.
Yeah, we were in the undergrad program, even though we met a lot of people that were in the grad program. But yeah, so you can at some point toward the end, you can kind of take both classes if you want and stuff. So, yeah.
And was there a big documentary, department or professor that was specifically about documentary at USC that was someone you guys gravitated to?
Not real. I mean, it's very a fiction driven program. And I think there is a documentary in the anthropology department. And so I think both Chris and I toward the end, I think we were kind of going in that direction. Like, and we didn't totally do documentary when we were in school, but then, we had a music video class at the end, which was actually one of these graduate level classes. And then that the teacher from that, class, he'd actually been involved with a lot of documentary stuff. So I think at the very end of film school, it was like, oh, documentary, that's really what I want to do, you know? And it kind of took like 4 years to figure out that that's actually the kind of film that I was interested in doing.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, building on what Jeff had said there, I mean, USC, being based in Los Angeles and kind of pre-digital video. I mean, we're talking about, we were trained on, Super 8 and 16 and 35 millimeter, and, video editing was just kind of starting to be integrated into the school. Is that, we're talking. A lot of the film is not really indie film. It's these kind of commercial, big budget sort of stuff. And I think both Jeff and I kind of like the kind of independent spirit of filmmaking in the sense of you and a friend could go and make a film. And documentaries were something that kind of allowed us to do that outside of kind of interacting with some interesting real world subjects. But this music video class Jeff was talking about, there was a former student, documentary filmmaker, Tom Neff. He was Academy Award nominated director for, film back in the 80s. And so he got involved in the country music industry in Nashville and came to USC. And he convinced a few record labels to give him some money and to kind of like train the next generation of music video directors. And so our kind of a spring semester senior year, we got a chance to take this music video class where basically each week people would kind of create pitches for these artists and one person would get selected to do a video for that month. And so over the course of the semester, we were supposed to make several videos. And soon after this class was finished, Tom decided to kind of launch this channel called the Documentary Channel. It's kind of at the middle of the dot-com boom, and that kind of created some gateways for, you know, doors of opportunity to kind of explore, you know, could we really go out and make documentaries?
Oh, that's awesome. I was curious, so when you started, did you guys plan on making narrative, like it, when you started your undergrad? You're thinking about going to USC film school to make like scripted stuff?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I was more drawn to this, the craft of making a film. And I think being young, it's like you didn't really think about documentary too much. Mm-hmm. And so I think by, you know, I was never like a big, okay, I'm a huge a fan of this particular movie, you know, kind of thing. So I think once you had the tools, and then it was just like trying to figure out over time, like what kind of voice, what kind of form were you interested in? And I think even, you know, I made a narrative film where there was a lot of like the main character speaking to the camera. And I realized later on, it's like, oh, I was really just trying to make a documentary, but it's like, it didn't come that realization. And then, you know, we were after that music video class and being kind of more aware of it, then Chris and I ended up, and that's how we ended up going and doing Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea. It was something that it's like, oh, we had an idea for a documentary. And then it's like, okay, well, you know, it didn't work out what we had pitched, you know, to get funding for it. It's like, oh, let's just go do it ourselves. And so I think, but it was really empowering at the time. And that was like when there was a lot of DV cameras were coming out and it was like, okay, possible to do that kind of thing with a limited budget.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think one of the kind of early hesitancies about deciding to go and make documentaries was this idea that one of the things I always liked about the kind of craft of, you know, filmmaking was the kind of visual storytelling element. And so many of the documentaries that I'd seen growing up didn't really have that. You know, they were kind of more kind of force feeding you ideas or kind of talking heads. And I think, you know, something Jeff and I joked about at some later point in time is that, you know, every semester you would see like the kind of graduating seniors projects or the master's programs. And it's like, all the documentary short films are always like so much better than the, like the fiction films, you know? And after a few semesters, it's like, oh, right. You know, what's the reason here of like, why are these films, you know, so much better? And part of it was kind of the authenticity and also just also the kind of approach people were taking.
Yeah, I remember seeing Errol Morris's Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. And that was like the thing like, oh, you can use these tools that we're learning here in film school to do something very visual, but in a nonfiction place. So I think seeing that was a huge eye opener. And so knowing that, oh, there's in it for me, it was always just like, oh, this is so interesting because, you know, being on a lot of a fiction film sets, it's like, I don't know. It's kind of boring, I think, to me. Cause it's like, oh, we already have a script. We already know what's going to happen. Like, all right. And now it's just executing it. Whereas a documentary, it's like, okay, it's more like an adventure or traveling where it's like, okay, you have an idea of something that you may want to tell this story about, but it was about like discovering it through the process. And I think that's what made it really a lot more exciting to me.
Yeah. Going back a little bit, were there any particular tropes of country music videos in the late 90s? Because I'm like, I don't remember. It wasn't really my genre, but I imagine like there were certain things that were just like that were just in particular to that that aesthetic. I don't know if there is something you remember that you studied with country music videos.
Well, you know, one of the things that was really neat about the opportunity is that, you know, not only were you able to kind of start making music videos that were going to hopefully be on CMT Country Music Television or other kind of outlets for real artists, is that the record company would bring different kind of consultants on set, like, you know, these, you know, kind of country music famous DPs are like, okay, this is the visual language of it. And so this was at a time when country music was kind of transitioning to kind of like more country pop, you know? And so for the life of me, I can't remember the DP's name. Jeff might remember. He stepped in one day. He's like, you guys are being like way too arty. He's like, you know, you need to make, these are celebrities, you know, you need to like, you know, make them look beautiful, you know? And so a lot of it was this kind of like very soft beauty lighting with, really just kind of separating from them from the background. Like, whereas I think many of us in the class, myself included, is like, you're thinking of it as a story, like a short film. And it's like, it's not a short film. It's like a brand film for, you know, this musician. Right. So I think a lot of that kind of beauty lighting technique was like, that was the first time I was introduced to it and was something that was really important for these country music stars that were wanting to compete with to be pop stars.
That's like the old school, like the Vaseline on the lens is how they used to do like in the olden days. Nice.
Yeah.
And obviously music plays a lot into all the films. Obviously, you've made a film about a rock band and also. I noticed like a lot of animation. We're talking about like another visual element you guys do. It seems like a lot of your productions you have. Is that something you specialized in or gravitated to, the animation aspect?
I think it's just it's a tool that I think is really liberating because there's, and in each of those instances, it was like trying to tell a part of the story where you didn't have footage. And it's like, how do you do that? And I think especially with rodents, like there was no historical footage, no photos, nothing. But the thing that was cool about doing that was we could look at historical things, like historical photos of like, what did a hunting, you know, camp look like in the 30s? And you could, you know, use these historical references, but you were liberated through animation to basically like show whatever you wanted to show, but try to do it, you know, as faithfully as possible to what actually happened.
Right. And so we should set the tone for the people that have not seen the film yet. Rodents of Unusual Size is about the Nutrias, who are a giant kind of badger rat creature from like Argentina. Is that right? Somewhere like
that. That's right.
And they brought them in during the 30s. Is that right? The Depression?
During the Great Depression.
You got it. Yeah.
For fur production, not meat production initially, right? Just fur. And then they just went, they got loose and reproduced like crazy. And they're in California now. I think I learned from your film. I'm like, oh man. So yeah, maybe let's, since this is the thing you all three worked on, do you want to talk a little bit about how you came to this story?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's, you know, great about making, you know, documentaries is that, you know, you're able to kind of work with who you want, and also their stories all around the world. And so, you know, Quinn has been kind of a longtime friend and filmmaker friend, you know, in the Bay Area. And we all kind of gravitated to kind of offbeat environmental documentaries, kind of like the Cane Tone story, you know. And one day Quinn was kind of talking about this documentary he wanted to make about Nutria in Louisiana. He had just gotten back from a trip there, and he was kind of fascinated that, you know, these giant kind of invasive rats had created such an environmental problem. And so the state was coming up with these creative ways to deal with it. And Jeff and I are like, well, we know about Nutria. We pitched an idea about that to some news channel that we were working with many years ago. And we're like, well, what's your take on it? You know? And Quinn, you want to take it from there?
Yeah. I basically had a friend who was an environmentalist, you know, who was just put in charge of trying to eradicate the Nutria around Lake Pontchartrain. And as she was describing her job, the thing about it that kind of I thought was really fascinating, it wasn't necessarily the animals, but the people that she was talking about working with, you know, the fact that she was like, you know, working with these fashion designers who were, you know, going to use the fur, and she was working with people who were like trying to cook the meat and all these different things. And I was just like, all these characters that she kept describing, I was like that. And they all kind of brought together by this huge rodent was just like, oh, this just is so kind of fun and interesting, you know. And so kind of had this idea, you know, in my head, and was really kind of thrilled that Chris and Jeff even knew what a Nutria was, and, you know, was surprised that they that this was something that was in their consciousness. You know what I mean? So as we kind of started to, you know, as we started to kind of talk and figure out, like, is there a movie there? We kind of started looking at the landscape of, like, well, what else, what has been done about these animals, and, you know, how much outside of the scope of Louisiana has these things gone? And the only major thing that we found was there was this reality show that had been produced in the mid 2000s called Rat Bastards. And it was like this really beefed up, super high production value kind of thing that just seemed like a cartoon. I mean, they were blowing up Nutria with grenades and all these different things. And not, and I was like, this is not technically legal. And it seemed like, oh, this is kind of strange, but seems to be missing a huge part of the story, which is kind of the resilience of the people who actually live in Louisiana, that it is this kind of really incredibly unique culture that's being in some, you know, under threat from all of this erosion that these large rats kind of bring about, but that they're holding on. Part of the way that they're holding on to their culture and everything is by hunting these large rodents for profit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the Cane Toads film, because that's totally what I was thinking when I saw this. I'm just like, this is like an updated version of which I love the Cane Toads movie. And I think like the humor that's sort of baked in there is in there. And it's like, you guys do a lot of stuff, which our favorite genres, I think, of documentary, it's like sort of like weird Americana. And I think this is like the American equivalent of the cane toad problem. I mean, or you could even look at like invasive species in like Hawaii or something like that. But this particularly, the fact that this ties into like what's going on with like how the swamplands are actually we're a buffer for all the storms. So it ties into what's happened with Katrina and everything like that as well. There's so many things that are connected to this one animal there's so many ways to slice and dice this animal, apparently, as is covered in the film.
You can wear them, you can eat them, and I think that's it was interesting to us because it's an environmental issue, but it's something that you would never expect. So I think it brings this awareness of these environmental problems, whether that's dealing with, you know, sea rise or hurricanes, but in a way that just you wouldn't expect at all. And I think that brings people in, but also the fact that you can tell this environmental story through human beings and how they're affected by things, whether that's the impact on their culture or whether, you know, our main character, Thomas, the island that his family's been living on for the last 250 years is going to go underwater. And so I think that seeing how not just like a nature film, but how, you know, these environmental issues can impact human beings, I think that's people can really relate to that, since we're all human beings too, and that you can like kind of maybe give a little more, you can kind of relate to it a little more.
Well, so I did have a question because you're all based in the Bay Area, right? So filming something in Louisiana over, I don't know how many years, it seemed like you were started working that. When did you start working on this? Cause I know you had a Kickstarter or some kind of fundraising thing to promote. I stumbled across your video where you're eating the sausages. So like that was like what, 2013 or something? So you've been working on this.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
5-6 year period.
Yeah, yeah. We started working on the film in the fall 2013, really kind of began production in the spring of 2014, and then the film was we did a theatrical release in 2017, 2018, and then the film was on Independent Lens on PBS in January of 2019. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely a long haul film, and part of that is basically going back and forth between California and Louisiana, and then it kind of a unique kind of situation in Louisiana in the sense that it gets really hot as fuck in Louisiana in the summertime. And so the Nutria are smart and basically hide all summer. And so we were kind of limited to the months of November to April to really film, to kind of really capture the story.
Mm. Now, can you describe the smells? Because that's one thing I like. Firstly, like a lot of carcasses. I was going to say, like, this is definitely like you can't put no animals were harmed during the shoot. Like, many animals were harmed during the shooting of this film.
But
I'm like, what do they smell like? I've not been around one. What's a living one like versus a dead one? I mean,
Well, Jeff is the one, as both a co-director and cinematographer, he's the one that was like up close and in the face of the carcasses.
Yeah, the smell, or the scratch and sniff. Yeah. Or the
Well, I mean, them is, and when they're alive, they're just, there's nothing bad. We actually had a trained nutria for some shots. Mm-hmm. So I was actually able to get up close and actually hold one. And then we brought her to a few screenings as well. But I think it's really like the scene where they're gutting the nutria. I was so focused on filming that I kind of didn't sink in. I think when you're looking, you know, at a screen or you're looking through a viewfinder, it's like not as real as, but I know the other two guys were about to lose their lunch, you know, but yeah, it doesn't smell good.
there's a scene in, where you go to like, this furrier's place where they basically, basically desiccate the carcass, you know, remove the fur and then of course treat it. And, you know, visually, you know, it's definitely, you know, hard to take. I mean, multiple animals being skinned in front of you, but you're basically, they're just emptying their intestines. So it smells like shit, you know?
Yeah.
And so, so it has a very like kind of minerally or kind of earthy smell, you know? But also just even being out in the swamps, I mean, you're out there trudging around in all this mud and it's all basically just, you know, decayed matter. And so, it has a very kind of earthy smell, mm-hmm. but it's one that, at least for myself, I think halfway through the furry interview, I was like, hey guys, I need to go step outside and get fresh air.
Right. I was thinking of just like how the swamps are just filled with carcasses, right? Like they're just so many because they're just taking the tails. So like there's a bunch that are just like there's just got to be piles of like rotting mammals. Just all, and like I've lived in a house, you know, we've all lived in the Bay Area. We've all been renters. Like if you have a dead rat in the wall, that's one thing. If it's a 20-pound dead rat, I cannot even imagine what it's like. Those are awful. Yeah.
We had to be more worried about, you know, every film has its own kind of production stories, but there's this parasite that lives on the nutria, and there's this thing called nutria itch. So you have to be really careful when you handle them, because if a little bit of the parasite gets underneath your skin, it just like you just want it's like 10 times as bad as like poison oak or poison ivy. Thankfully, none of us get it, but like it supposedly drives you insane, like ringworm, you know? And so you just imagine there's all these, you know, at first you're like, you're filming, but at the downtime show, like you want to help your, you know, the people that are, you're participating in your documentary. Like, oh, I'll help carry you some carcasses back to the thing. And you're like, no guy, you know, you want to put your rubber gloves on before you start swinging these rats around.
Many people did not have gloves during this. That was the other thing. I was like,
oh yeah.
I was like, what is going on? Like, and you didn't even include that. Like of all the, you didn't include that segment that there is like a parasite living in these things.
Yeah.
Like there's gotta be so much cutting room floors, like bits like that. Well, that like this probably could have been 4 hours long. I imagine there's so much to cover with this animal. But yeah, parasite, great. Let's talk. Add that part in.
Well, that was a storytelling challenge that we had to kind of deal with that we knew going into it, in the sense that we wanted people to be kind of aware of what the process was, but not so turned off that they wouldn't empathize with the people, the characters in our film, you know? And it's something that Jeff and I had learned really early on. We'd done a documentary called Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea about this kind of environmental disaster in Southern California, the Salton Sea. And when we were editing that film, we realized that if we put too much negative stuff in there, people would only walk away with the negative feeling, even if it was a tiny amount. And so even when we were kind of like, when Quinn was editing these scenes, it's like he was kind of, you know, he was kind of conducting these scenes of like, okay, well, where do we want to kind of have like the gross out moment, but then where do we want to pull it back so that, you know, people aren't just going to turn off the channel if it's on TV or, you know, because you want people to get to the end. And he did a great job of threading that needle there.
Yeah, well, I had to pull back the gross out factor in the opening of the movie, because especially for PBS, you don't want people to turn the thing off.
And when you look at like a lot of films that have been made in Louisiana, like especially about the ones about these communities that are disappearing, there's this just sense of kind of like hopelessness and, you know, how are we going to, you know, we're not going to survive and we're being destroyed. And it's actually, that's all true. But the actual experience of actually being there and spending time is like, this just overwhelming, contagious joy, you know, that everybody is kind of projecting. So, you know, that was an interesting thing when you're there. It's like you're not kind of it's like it's such a joyful thing, even though they know, like, they've lost, you know, Thomas, our, one of our main characters, lost his house three times, probably going to lose it again, you know, and from hurricanes and all these things. So that was definitely something where we were like, we want that to come across, you know, that kind of spirit, even with the full knowledge that, you know, this, there's a lot to despair about at the same time. You know?
Yeah, there's like a celebratory nature to the film, which I wasn't expecting. And it sort of like reminded me of like Les Blanc or something, like, you know, sort of like, especially yeah. all the music and the cooking and all that aspect to it. Like, it's really just an interesting way to view that entire culture, which I've yeah. never been there and never experienced. And,
well, yeah, it's very much a part of it. And I think it's really how they deal as a culture and a people with all this tragedy that's always on their doorstep, whether it be hurricanes or, you know, legions of giant rats or whatever it is. And it's just like you really start to see that in the people, and that's how they're able to deal with all these kind of horrible things.
I was going to say, like, the first time I ever heard about a nutria was from a musician from New Orleans, Quintron, if you know Quintron. But he does these puppet shows and made this Christmas video yeah. called, like, North Pole Nutrias. I'm like, that's my
right. Okay.
My friend from Alabama, I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? They're like, oh, you don't know about these things? There's these giant yeah. rodents all over the South. Yeah, so this would be a good time to throw to a clip from Rodents of Unusual Size.
Prior to the Nutri Control Program, we had a pilot study to try and promote Nutri for human consumption. We made sausage with it. We made Slim Jims. We made Nutria hot tamales. We had Nutria gumbo, things that people were used to eating in South Louisiana.
Cooking is improv, just like jazz. Whether I play a high note or a low note, play softer or play louder, people come gather, and we're not gonna tell them it's nutrient. Say, come on, try my chicken. And we'll tell them the next day so they don't regurgitate.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So Quinn, you found the story about, you found Kermit as a subject?
Well, I was a big fan of Kermit Ruffins. He's a jazz musician. You know, he kind of has this kind of zealot, you know, quality to him. He's been on, you know, Treme playing himself. He's kind of like this dude that you run across in New Orleans. He owns a bar there and a restaurant that he cooks at. And Jeff and I were big fans, and we went to one of his shows, you know, in New Orleans after shooting down there, and he played, and then he was kind of talking to people after the show, and he was like, you know, what are you guys, you know, what's up with you, you know? And we were like, oh, you know, we're making this movie about Nutria, and he's like, oh, Nutria, I used to catch those as a kid down in the Ninth Ward to cook them, and I'm really good at cooking them, and you guys should come film me, you know, barbecuing a nutria at my restaurant. And so, you know, we were like, that sounds amazing. And so he was like, you know, I need you to get me the nutria because he lost his connection, you know, but he's like, you got to bring it with the feet on, head on, because that way I know it's not a cat. And I don't know if he was kidding about that or not. How many times? He seemed pretty serious, you know. Anyway, it was really easy to get a Nutria because we had been filming Nutria Hunters for, you know, many days. And so, you know, and then he showed up with this huge bag of spices and everything. And he started like cooking it up. And it was really fun to see all these people that kind of hang out. There's just this kind of satellite of people that are always kind of hanging out around him at this restaurant, and them all kind of like standing there watching him do it and all kind of daring each other, like, I'm going to eat it. No, I'm not going to eat it. Hell no, I'm not going to eat that thing. And, but he made it, and it was just like, it was really, really delicious and really wonderful. And almost everybody, you know, that was on the fence eventually decided to go for it.
Yeah, and his secret ingredient seemed to be both Abita beer and then Lipton French onion soup.
French onion soup. Oh, yeah.
The powder or whatever.
Yeah, the powder. A lot of the powder of French Lipton soup.
Yeah, throw it on anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is kind of one of those films, and going into it, we knew there were going to be like a lot of like what the fuck moments, you know? And the idea would be is that people would want to watch the film because of that, but then through it, they get a chance to kind of meet these wonderful people that we got to go on these adventures with. And so it's this kind of collision of a film like, you know, Cane Toads or like Bradley Beasley's Oakley Noodling, and then some of, you know, Les Blank's classic films, which were, you know, definitely always kind of favorites of all of ours, but particularly Quinn, the Les Blank fan. And mm-hmm. so we kind of wanted to kind of merge these different, you know, approaches. And we kind of also, I mean, with some of the films that Jeff and I had previously made, they were very much stories of both the present and history and lots of talking heads. And this one, we wanted to kind of take kind of a faux cinema verite style in the sense of like really, you know, the landscape of Louisiana is so much a part of what's at threat and also so much of what these people depend on. And so we really wanted to kind of visually be able to kind of capture this kind of otherworldly feeling of what's it like beyond the bayous. These folks are, you know, hunting the nutria or doing other things of life like crabbing, et cetera.
Yeah. So had you all spent time in that area in Louisiana before this, or Quinn, you'd spend a lot of time there, or your friend was there and then you got the stories and research?
I hadn't spent a lot of time. And so I think, you know, part of this was just looking for an excuse to go kind of hang out there. And I think whenever you are deciding what kind of film you want to make, it kind of comes into play a little bit about like, is this a place I really want to hang out for, you know, maybe a few years, you know? And so it was just kind of like a lot of people, you know, cliche is like falling in love with New Orleans. There was just something kind of so kind of infectious and unique and everything about being down there. So it was, I heard about this the first time I went and was kind of obsessed with going back.
Yeah. And I think, you know, while I know it's not necessarily so kosher within the documentary community now, but I mean, a lot of the stories that we gravitate to are places that are not necessarily in our backyard, you know? And it's like, you know, when we're making these films, it's like, we're not treating these people as like the other, or we have these objectives. It's like, we really just want to kind of immerse ourselves and learn. And we hope that through kind of our outsider perspective, while embracing the people that live there, that kind of synthesis kind of captures some sort of truth about these experiences. Because too often we found that a lot of the other films that were made about, you know, the wetlands or nutria issues, it's like they kind of took some of the beauty of the place for granted, you know, and just kind of wanted to be kind of more agitprop about like, you know, the issues, you know, and mm-hmm. we felt like people will do something about the issues if they love the place and the people that are there, you know? And so, you know, in the end, it's always, you try to kind of tread lightly in the sense of like that you're not making assumptions about places, and you try to go in to, with a kind of an open mind. And so, the thing we always kind of figure is the kind of the test of whether we did a good job or not, or like, what do the people in the film think of the film, and then other people in the community. And with Rodents of Unusual Size and other ones, it's, you know, when Thomas and his wife were at the screening, you know, they were kind of holding back some tears about, you know, it kind of captured a moment that they were just kind of living through and not quite
seen it in the same way. And when they could see it through our eyes, they're like, now we understand why you kept on coming back. and it was great to be able to kind of celebrate with them in that way.
Yeah. And Thomas's son is also featured in the film talking about this sort of like the ending of the generations of people that are going to be living in that area. Like as he moved further inland and, like, it seems like, and also, like, he doesn't have the same accent that his dad has. There's obviously, like, some kind of, like, you know, the culture. It does seem like I don't know very much about this Cajun culture at all. It's a very distinct American culture that I think most Americans don't know a lot about. It's as evidenced by you had to have subtitles on almost everything that Thomas was saying in the film. But yeah, he has that spirit of like the guys in the Les Blank movies, like the guy who's like cooking all the garlic and stuff. You know, he has that kind of energy. So it's a really good character portrait, and like he's sort of your lens through a lot of. I mean, there's also the guy. The fascinating thing to me is this guy who like works for the forestry company, and his job is just like, well, I count up all the tails and I throw them in the freezer. Like, there's just so many weird moments like that I think are so that stick with me from this film. It's a really fun film that treats you bring in the humanity of everyone, and like you care about the issues because you end up caring about the people. I started Googling a little bit about what's going on with the nutria in California and found there's maybe a congressman who brought a stuffed nutria to Congress to talk about like funding or like the fact that there's nutria all over California now as well. Been following up about? Yeah, people probably just send you news clips all the time because they're like, oh, those are my nutria friends, right?
Yeah, I volunteered on. His name is Josh Harder, and he flipped a seat in Modesto, and I worked on that campaign, and then. And then was surprised to see that that issue was one of the things that he kind of took up as his mantle, you know, in the sense of like this, the nutria are now showing up in, you know, the Central Valley. The Central Valley, of course, is very reliant on this series of canals and everything. And they, of course, just like in Louisiana, they degrade the integrity of these canals. And so, it's something they are not used to dealing with, trying to figure out how to deal with it. And one of the ways that he has kind of been raising awareness around the issue is actually bringing nutria to Washington and be like, can you believe this shit? Can you believe this? he actually has been pretty successful in bringing home the bacon to that district. And he just won re-election for the first time.
Well, so like, how are they getting... Yeah. Around do you think people are importing them? Are they just running wild all over the lower 48 now?
Well, and Quinn has actually a little bit of backstory here that's kind of, you know, humorous, but like 75, 80 years ago, all throughout the United States, you know, hunting and fur was kind of a big business. And people saw these 20 or 30 pound giant rats and thought like, well, we can raise them in fur farms and we can make a killing off of them. And so while in Louisiana, it really took off because in the sense that once they escaped, it was just kind of a Garden of Eden for the nutria. This same story happened in many other states, including, I think, Quinn's stepfather's father, you know, kind of lost all the family money, you know, trying to raise nutria back in like the 50s. And so there's been pockets of nutria over the decades, and states have kind of done their best to combat them. But with climate change and global warming, more areas around the United States have more ideal situations for the nutria to kind of take hold. And so one of the things that we do get into in the film is that nutria are really kind of prolific reproducers. So like when a nutria is 3 months old, they're ready to start having babies. They can have babies within 3 to 6 months. They can have like 6 to 10 babies at a time, those babies. And so, I mean, if you think rabbits breed fast, the nutria just are crazy. And that's the reason why they've been kind of able to take hold. And the states that are most threatened are, you know, California, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, Oregon, areas that have kind of lots of wetlands area and also are kind of moderate temperatures.
Oh, man. Yeah. And also they kind of like supplant, are they just kind of destroyed the muskrat population. Is that right? Were they like competing for the same resources, or maybe even eating the muskrats? Like, do you know? Do they eat other mammals too? Is that right, or am I guessing?
Not really. I mean, they're mostly vegetarians, mm-hmm. but yeah, I think they just pushed out resources of the muskrats. Like, and so yeah, they can kind of have a devastating impact. I mean, the biggest thing that they have an impact on is just coastal erosion, because they eat the roots that hold the land together. So they'll just, you know, decimate dikes and levees and a lot of water control areas. So somewhere like the Central Valley does have these like canals and things. It's like, that could be a huge problem.
Yeah, and also the other thing you guys pointed out in the film is that the fact that places like PETA, because they were so anti-fur, then they just took out any economic incentive. And so this economic incentive right now is just basically, is it federal government money to just pay people for the tails? So it's
absolutely
like creating this market in a way. And then, yeah, it seems like you guys talk a lot about like basically – What are like market solutions to this problem? That ends up
it's a funny economic problem. Basically, there was a demand for fur, and when no one wanted fur anymore, they had to kind of stimulate that. So now there's a bounty program, $5 a tail. And so that's basically just giving these hunters that know the land the best the financial incentive to go out and get these things. So because there's no way they could, now you can sell them for a dollar or something, a pelt, and so it just doesn't make it worth their while.
Have you, so since COVID's happened, I'm wondering how this is, I was watching the Kermit, you know, restaurant and thinking about like, oh God, I wonder what they're going through right now. And then just like all the other types of jobs that went away. If the government's still offering $5 a tail, I wonder if more people have gotten in the game, even subsequent to watching your film, you know, mm-hmm. and like, I'm also like, are those like BB, are they like guns or BB guns? Or I don't know. They seem like to pop off. Like mm-hmm. they seem pretty easy to kill in the way.
You guys they either use a 22, which is basically kind of like a cap gun in some ways, but no, and or a shotgun, like a 20 gauge shotgun. So that it, and we were kind of told that if, you know, since we were filming them, we have to you know, shoot a gun as well. So that was kind of part of the. Which I had never done before.
Did you nail some nutria?
Yeah, one. Yeah. And it wasn't that hard. And that was with a 20 gauge shotgun.
They don't go that fast, right? They seem to kind of, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, while there are a lot of nutria out there, I mean, the folks that, you know, we spent time with, it's like they grew up hunting and fishing all the time. Mm-hmm. And so, if I went out, you know, and tried to get a few nutria, I'm sure I'd get a few over the day. But like the folks that went out with, I mean, they're really good shots. And I mean, mm-hmm. the ones that are using the 22. And so when we're out with this one family, the Oakway family, it's like if they went out with an airboat, which would get them to some areas that are kind of a little bit further out, they could get 600 to 800 in a day, you know, like two or three of them in a family working together. Whereas I think if Jeff Quinn and I went out for a day on airboat, maybe we'd bring a dozen, you know? So yeah. You definitely have to have the skill, and that's the incentive, is like to incentivize these people. The people that have these skills have kind of diminished over time just because, you know, like so many other parts of the country, it's suburbanized and people mm-hmm. would rather play video games than, you know, go hunting, even though a lot of people still fish and hunt in Louisiana.
Yeah. I may be in Modesto, that's, or wherever they are now. Like that's the other way you can take them out, just get people to hunt them. So this is available to watch. Where can people watch Rodents of Unusual Size?
So Rodents of Unusual Size is kind of available on most of the kind of digital streaming platforms like iTunes, Amazon Prime, a few other places. But, you know, the go-tos, iTunes, okay. You know, Apple and Amazon are probably the good places to kind of hit up.
Yeah. Nice. Canopy, too, if you're of a library.
Oh, yeah. Card. Love Canopy.
Oh, yeah. It's Canopy, yep. Yeah.
Oh, and we should give a pop to, maybe you guys have already covered it on the podcast before, but Means TV, they're kind of a collectivist, anarchist-run kind of Netflix. And so they have Rodents of Unusual Size on it, too.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I think one of our past guests is a Means TV person, yeah. So I've heard a little bit about that. Great. I also want to talk to you guys about Everyday Sunshine, which I actually saw at the Roxy I think Angela was there. I don't know if you guys were both there at that screening as well. I mean, there might have been a whole weekend of screenings. I'm trying to remember. This is obviously like, you know, 2011 or something. It was quite a while ago.
Yeah, I think we both Jeff and co-director Lev were there. Usually, you know, with any of our films, when we're out doing kind of the theatrical circuit, we try to do as many Q&As as possible, just because, you know, when you're making a documentary, you're stuck in the editing room for such a long period of time. It's kind of nice to get out and, you know, meet people from the audience and grab drinks afterwards. And also, while there are a lot of kind of repetitious questions you always get in Q&As, there's always ones that kind of throw you for the loop where you're like, I didn't think about the film in that way. And that's, you know, as a filmmaker, that's an interesting thing to kind of experience, of like how people kind of interpret your work. Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool that you were at the Roxy.
Yeah, I remember Kamau Bell and Nato Green were there as well, because I think that's when I first met Nato. So I remember that screening, and I remember Angela being there. And like I think some of us, like roughly the same generation, like they were as big as any other band on MTV in their kind of 120 minutes era of music. And like I remember seeing like Tapeheads and being like, oh, these guys are in Tapeheads. They were like so ubiquitous in a certain point in time, and then it seems like watching the story again, because it's been a while since I've seen it, I'm just like, it's very frustrating of like the talent that's there. And like, maybe this is just like a trope of a lot of music documentaries, is that, you know, you get your talking head people that are like, yeah, they were the biggest influence on me, and I'm now a multimillionaire. And then it's like, this is Angelo's living with his mom. It's so frustrating to watch. And then I was also thinking about it, but now, and I think it's in the film, but now I really wonder, like, you know, given everything else that we've been talking about this year, like how much race is really a factor in them not taking off, like in that time period, or like, you know, that alternative music at the time or college rock at the time was not diverse and really didn't have a lot of African-American like representation. I don't know if you've thought more about that recently since I mean, the film's like you finished it 10 years ago, so I don't know how much you revisit it. But do you have any thoughts about that? It's just sort of a broader thought I was having.
Well, you know, I'd been thinking about it recently, just in the sense of, you know, obviously I'm preparing for this interview, but also kind of recently been doing some Skype Q&As with Angelo and other folks in the band, because like the Black Rock Coalition, who's this nonprofit that's all kind of talked about the kind of underrepresentation of black musicians in rock music, and been doing some fundraising screenings and things. And so much of what's, you know, happened in the world this last year in regards to kind of relations, it's like, you can kind of see the mirror in it in a lot of things that were going on in the late 80s and early 90s. And so while obviously it's very different, I think race always kind of played a role in the kind of lack of access that Fishbone had, you know. I think they were still given lots of opportunities. And so there were multiple things that kind of led to the kind of like crash and burn of the band. But mm-hmm. I think that by the time the crash and burn happened, it's that, in some ways, they hadn't been given the opportunities earlier on to kind of take hold. And because, I mean, one is, you know, they were a group of, you know, six black musicians, you know, five from South Central LA, one from the white Woodland Hills suburban valley. But then two is that they were mixing all these different types of music, you know, and I think that was the thing that, when you look at the bands that went on to be successful, is they decided just to kind of pull back on the variety and just focus on like, okay, well, we're going to do pop music, but with a little bit of ska, or we're going to add a little bit of metal to pop or whatever. Whereas Fishbone is like, they never wanted to hold themselves back. And that's the beauty of it. But at the same time, you know, when you work in a commercial industry, often kind of setting those guardrails, I think, is really important, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like there's just like inherently so much creativity going on in what they're doing that it's like, it's difficult to market. Like just, there's so many stylistic things going on, and they didn't really do like Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of became like a ballad band at a certain point, right? They kind of had some stuff that could be like ballady, but it's like so it's not in the same way that the Chili Peppers did. But I keep thinking about like, yeah, like they had an amazing stage presence. They had an amazing live show. And it is, you know, did the times just move away from rock music or ska just kind of like, you know, they're associated with ska became unpopular at a certain point. There's so many like factors. But then really, I remember a little bit about Kendall running off. And then this legal case about a kidnapping claim. And I'm like, that had to be kind of like that in the film. It really becomes like, oh, yeah, like that's definitely a point at which like they were at their most commercially viable point to have a major member songwriter like leave and then have a lawsuit come out of it or criminal case come out of it. Yeah, it's a very crazy story.
Well, and that's one that I think I reflect on a little bit differently now with the film finished and the times there is that, you know, they were, you know, on they were going to be on the Lollapalooza tour, you know, and, you know, Kendall had kind of a mental breakdown and they wanted to kind of intervene and get him treatment and because they thought he had joined this cult. And they went and, quote unquote, kidnapped him off the streets of Marin and were going to take him back to the hospital in L.A. And so, of course, they were arrested and were facing 10, 20 years in jail for these kidnapping charges. And obviously, I think the DA saw them like, hey, there's this MTV band. I can kind of make a name of it. But to be honest, like, look, it's a couple of black guys that are, alleged to be kidnapping, you know, and I can guarantee you this, if like the Red Hot Chili Peppers were doing that with Flea, I'm not sure if they would have been treated in the same way. I think they would have been given more the benefit of the doubt of like, hey, look, you know, maybe this wasn't the right way to go about doing it, but it wasn't kidnapping. I think their race definitely played a role in the way the legal system approached it.
In Marin, no less. Yeah.
Yes.
And of all the places. Yeah. So since the two of you worked on this, Jeff, did you end up going to like Hungary and France with them, or where did?
Yeah. We did two European tours, and but then when we started putting together the film, then we were continuing to film, and then like someone like Kendall showed it up at a show in Berkeley. So I mean, I was just there. Like we would just like so it, there was three of us, so we would. I was just there by myself, and I'm just like, all right, get another Fishbone show. Like you know, I've heard this before, and then suddenly Kendall's there, and he's like, so then I'd like in the back in the tour bus with him, and then Kendall's like, you know, hey, can you give me a ride home? And I'm like, all right, and I'm like calling the other guys. I'm like, I got Kendall in the car right now. Like, what should I do with him? And I'm like driving him from Berkeley to Marin because he, you know, and we're not sure like kind of where he lived and everything. But so that was an interesting time. And he's telling me about how like he wants to like do it only a ska band. And it's like, but it was just this, to know this story and what happened. And suddenly this guy's like sitting in the passenger seat and you're like, where do you want me to drop you off in San Rafael? Like, no, just this gas station. And I'm like, you know, so it, and then, but the, slowly we started to have more and more contact with Kendall and, you know, he played that night, he played with the band and stuff. So it was, we were kind of captured the band at kind of a low point, you know, like Angel living with his mom. I don't think he lives with her anymore, but it was just like, okay. And now, you know, a lot of the original members have come back and stuff. So, you know, we got this really like, you know, dramatic time in their career. But I think, you know, it's just spoke to this. It was just a really emotional thing to see that because you saw a lot of pain in them. It's like, I mean, especially for Angelo, it's like his brother left him. And, you know, whether that was, I don't think it was personal, but it's like, you know, it was a lot of this like personal relationships that you got to see. And now you've kind of seen that mended over time since the film. So,
yeah, no, that's like a very pivotal part of the film because I saw it in the theater. I remember in the theater thinking like, what is happening, especially like at the Shattuck down low of all places. And then, knowing that that happens again, watching the second time, I was like, oh yeah, it's interesting that like you get almost everyone to talk except for Kendall in the first half of the film. And then Fish, not at all, like the drummer. And he is back in the, I just kind of did my own digging around. It seemed like as of like a year ago, almost everyone was back in the live band except for Kendall, who appeared to want to be back on stage as of, you know, was that 2009 or something when that
happened? Yeah, 2009. Yeah. And so, yeah, everybody's back in the band. And actually, Kendall just played with them just for one show for an Alice in Chains tribute in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, like a lot of these things, everybody just has to be kind of in the right place at the right time. And so who knows if Kendall ever rejoin, but the thing that we kind of always valued is kind of, you know, filmmakers, not so much for what made it into the film, but like that these kind of friendships were kind of repaired. And so at least, you know, Kendall's been in contact with at least Norwood and Angelo and Chris Dowd frequently over the years. And so that was it was kind of this kind of very cathartic thing that you could see in the sense that, like, whether they were going to be in a band together anymore, at least they could be, you know, friends.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that Walt came back based on some stuff he was saying. But, like, look, I mean, you guys are three collaborators that work together. I'm sure you've run into the same dynamics that bands have, like creative differences or whatever. There's just sort of like a way you just kind of put up with it until you can't put up with it anymore. That's often, I think, the way a lot of like, you know, creative projects end up going. And it's just it's amazing to see sort of the faith that Norwood and Angelo had in the band to keep it going with all these other people through these really dry times. Sort of like, it's nice to see this post, you know, 10 years after this film's done, that they're, you know, they're actually able to, like, you know, collaborate again. And I mean, like what they're saying in the film where he's like, we should be playing a thousand seat rooms and not like a half full 500 seater. And like, yeah, like Shattuck Down Low, I don't think I've been down there, but I'm like, that can't be more than 300 people down there, right? It's like a tiny, I'm like, this is a band I saw at like the Shoreline Amphitheater, you know, like I remember just Angela running up and down the entire stairwells of the Shoreline Amphitheater. I'm just like, oh, this is like crazy. There's a rock star right here. And then, you know, when that was the only size of a venue that I would ever go to, when I knew about. So yeah, just but like, yeah, like Anvil is another film I just saw recently. Or I'm just, watch this again. I'm like, this is a lot like Anvil. Like, it's the same kind of like this weird brotherhood of non-brothers, you know, like just really having to, like, for the sake of this other goal, put aside their differences and stuff and just be tied, be basically, they're more married than married people is the crazy thing about it.
Yeah. I was ready to break the band up. I was done.
Me too. You
know, I was done because I'm like, I don't want to be in a band with Dr. Mad Vibe. I want to be in a band with fucking Angelo.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. What about that? I'm forced to be in a band with Dr. Mad Vibe, who I don't want to be in a band with.
I got creativity overflowing, and I can't get it all done here, and so it creates a backup in me, which becomes toxic, right? And so I have to get it out some other kind of way. Motherfuckers are asking me not to be me.
Okay. It ain't got nothing to do with your stage show, you know? And it ain't personal.
I feel like I don't have any control over shit.
Well, you ain't the only one. We all fall into that bag, and that's what you are forgetting.
I know I'm not the only one.
That's what you, and you're looking at me like it's more me than, but it ain't that way.
Stop listening to each other. What's the point?
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Well, I also would love to talk about salt, plagues and pleasures in, on the Salton Sea, if you guys have a second to talk about that. I just went there for the first time last year, and I was like, what is going on in this place? I had not seen the film at that point, but now it all kind of makes sense. And I think you were saying how you feel like it does tie back into rodents, in because it's sort of to deal with invasive species in a way. Man is the invasive species, I guess, in this version of the story.
Well, yeah, I think it's another environmental story told through the people that have to deal with it. I mean, the thing with Salton Sea has a lot to do with is the salinity of just there's no outlet of the sea, and that concentrates the salinity, and it makes it, less oxygen for fish. So it has a real image problem when you have tons of fish dying on the shoreline. But we really liked, just like Louisiana, where it's like people have this certain appreciation for, a lot of my people might see it as like this horrible place, but you know, like, oh, out in the swamp, but they really see like the joy of that. And I think that like the love for life was really empowering for us to see there, especially in that environment.
Yeah. Has anyone followed up with Mr. Land? Or is that his name? Like the, I'm like,
Mr. Has
the landman.
The landman has like, have the prices gone up at all? And since like you guys made this film, I'm like, I was very curious to like go on Zillow and see what like it's looking like out there right now.
You know, so the Salton Sea hasn't really changed in regards to this kind of economic cycle since we produced the film. Unfortunately, a lot of people in the film have kind of passed away over the years. The landman now lives in the Dominican Republic and is running real estate there. But I think, unfortunately, like when we were making Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea, is that 2020 was the year that basically was predicted that the Salton Sea would die and evaporate, and it basically would be the kind of there's no going back area. And unfortunately, that prophecy has come true in the sense that as the water has been kind of diverted to Los Angeles and San Diego, the Salton Sea continues to shrink and there become these dust storms. And so in all likelihood, this 10 years from now, if we're talking about the Salton Sea, people are like, what are you talking about? What is that? You know? And so people are still trying to kind of save it and do the things. But as I think something Jeff and I discovered during the making of the film is that there's this continued cycle of optimists who want to believe in this dream, and that it just kind of, it never quite comes to fruition. And part of that's just because, you know, it was never intended to be this way. And it's kind of outside the purview of like a place that people care about, you know? And so often when people, the things that make the Salton Sea special, where you can kind of live life how you want, also means that people don't give a shit about you. And so when you need help, they're not aware enough of the problems. And so I think by the time the problems we're aware of became more familiar to people out there in the world, it was kind of too late and too expensive to do anything.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And that was the first feature you both worked on, is that right? Or directing?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, we... going back to our USC time, so when this documentary channel was being started up by Tom Neff, a documentary filmmaker, he approached Jeff and I and he said, do you guys want to do this? This is like before reality series were really popular. He's like, do you want to make this show for me? America's Treasures is about offbeat, unseen corners of the world. And they're like, or of America. And we're like, yeah, sounds great. You know, take a camera, go on a road trip. And so he's like, okay, we'll come up with an idea for the show and come up with like a list of like episodes for the first season. And the Salton Sea was one of those ideas. And with the kind of dot-com implosion, there wasn't any funding there. Eventually, the documentary channel did launch. But Jeff and I, kind of empowered by some, you know, Final Cut Pro version 1 and, you know, mini DV camera, decided to kind of head out to the Salton Sea. We were familiar there. They're familiar with the Salton Sea because we shot a music video there for a contemporary Christian band at one point in time. And we just, you know, we'd never made a feature film before. We never made a documentary. And so, you know, as Jeff often says, this was kind of our documentary film school. And so we kind of learned by doing.
Yeah, yeah. I like the certain edits you guys do where you kind of have these opposing, alternating takes on it. Like, it's just like really speaks to like just like the subjective experiences of people in a place like that.
Yeah. But I think that's what's interesting. There was a screening in San Francisco at a certain warehouse that some people I remember were just like, that place is horrible. And they saw the same film, you know? So I think it's interesting when you can take different takeaways just depending on where you're coming from. So I think, you know, you definitely come in, you might have your own preconceptions, but it's all about how you look at it, I guess.
Yeah. Something that's common with all three of these films that we've worked on is that, I mean, you know, even with Riddance and Unusual Sides, like, we all have our own kind of opinions or our takes on things, but we're really wanting to kind of create films that kind of make people ask some kind of big and difficult questions and draw their own conclusions. And so we're not asking you to kind of come to the same conclusion as us, but just kind of take a ride and, you know, think about it. And, you know, some people, you know, think the Nutria should be wiped out. Others think that they should just be left to Gikon, or, you know, that it's gross that people are eating them, or the salt and sea should be saved. And so a lot of this is just kind of presenting these contrasts in, you know, these films. You know what I mean? Like, if you see Everyday Sunshine, it's like, we're not asking you to fall in love with a band or love their music, but maybe see, why do people maybe like or love this band so much? Or why do people Louisiana? It's like, you don't have to love or like it yourself. We just want you to understand why others might feel differently.
Yeah. I was surprised to see that John Waters was the narrator on Plagues and Pleasures. And then I noticed, like, that's like you always have these sort of surprise narrators. Like, I remember, like, laughing out loud at the Roxy when I saw Lawrence Fishburne narrating the Fishbone documentary, just because of the pun. I'm like, did they do this just for the pun, or like, what is the background here? The casting, or like, do you think of it as casting when you're getting narrators, or how do you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely it's casting. I think it's like trying to set a tone in some way. So, I mean, of course, I think with a documentary, you don't have any star power. You don't have like, okay, who's your starring role? But you have a narrator. So, I mean, that helps, I think, in promoting the film a bit. But I think like having the right tone, like we had an earlier cut of The Salton Sea, and we had a very kind of like ominous voiceover, and it didn't set the right tone. Right from the beginning, John Waters says it's okay to like not make fun of these people, but it's okay that this is like, you know, we're not taking this totally seriously, you know, and I think, you know, with Wendell Pierce, like we were kind of said, hey, you're like telling a tale on the bayou, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like a little bit in character. Mm-hmm. So for him, it was a bit of a performance. And I mean, I think Fishburne was like, Chris probably knows more, but I think that was just sheer coincidence.
Yeah, was he a fan, or what was the story there?
Yeah, he's a big fan, yeah.
Yeah, well, a little bit of background. I think I can speak for the three of us. It's like, I don't think any of us ever imagined that we'd be making documentaries with voiceover narration, because like, it's kind of anathema to like, as a filmmaker or director, it's like you want to show, not tell, you know. But it just so happens that, you know, a lot of the projects that we've approached is that there's these kind of bigger stories that we need to kind of establish a framework for, or in some ways, you know, the tone, as Jeff had said. And so it just so happened with the process through Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea, we realized how much the tone changed once John Waters came on board. And so that was kind of a learning experience for us. So when we were exploring different narrators for the Fishbone doc, we were trying to figure out, like, okay, who's from this scene? You know, who could speak from it? And it just so happened to be that Lawrence Fishburne was kind of not just a fan of the band, but like longtime friends. It's like he was growing up in Hollywood at the same time they were cutting their teeth in the Hollywood scene, and they would sleep on each other's couches. And in some ways, some of the challenges that Lawrence Fishburne dealt with in Hollywood as a black actor were the same things that they dealt as black musicians in it. And so while we were able to approach him because he was their friend, it was these other underlying components that really made him the perfect narrator, because he could empathize and understand and tell the story because in some ways, he lived a mirror version of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so he offered to do it because he loved the guys in the band, but he was able to bring something different to it, not just his name, but the experience. And so with Wendell Pierce, you know, we were going through lots of narrators, you know, and we knew about Wendell Pierce very early on, but we just didn't think he was the right person because, at least for myself, the character that I'm aware of him for is like The Wire. And you're like, no, he's not the guy, but we'd run around and see him in New Orleans, and we knew his story. And we just decided to give it a go and reach out. And then next you know, it's like you meet him in person. It's like, oh, of course, he has a Louisiana accent. It's like he grew up with family, you know, eating and cooking Nutria. It's like, so it's a lot of these narrators, we've kind of found them through serendipity and then realized that, like, you know, the things that first attracted to them isn't really the reason why they made the perfect narrator, but these kind of other things that you discover.
Right. So with Waters, had he spent any time at Salton Sea, or just like his tone was the thing that you were going for?
He hadn't, but he always describes the Salton Sea as like Baltimore with water. So that's like, so I think it's kind of more like the types of people that hang out there up his alley. So,
oh yeah, you got two Baltimore heads. Like you got the like Bunk and The Wire and John Waters. So where can people catch all these films? Like all three of these films we already referenced, you can go on iTunes to watch Rodents of Unusual Size. What about with Everyday Sunshine and Plagues and Pleasures?
So I think with all three films are on, you know, Apple iTunes and Amazon. And, you know, unfortunately, while some of the films have been on Netflix at different points in time, Netflix is not very kind to older titles. So typically, I think Everyday Sunshine is going to be on Canopy next year. Everyday Sunshine's on Topic. The Salton Sea, actually, I think is still on KQED's Truly California for free on YouTube, I think, like the TV version. You know, but obviously, you know, these are all older titles. And so I think they can all be found on, you know, iTunes. And
speaking of Lawrence Fishburne, we're probably in the Matrix. Good
place to go. And
but it was cool with both with Lawrence Fishburne and with Wendell Pierce. Like when you meet them at the VO session, and then they just wanted to talk for a long time. Like both of them, just like Lawrence Fishburne's like, oh, Fishburne this and that, and it's like, you know, and then Wendell Pierce is like talking about Nutria and stuff. So it was really cool with both of them. Like they really felt connected to the subject, and I think that helped a lot. You know, and why they kind of felt invested in the project. You know.
Yeah, I also want to say I watched the Heath Ceramics documentary just this morning because I was like, I didn't really know the whole backstory with that. And that's pretty fascinating as well. I know there's certainly these things you guys do as a company. Some of them are like for nonprofits and some are like, you know, I guess like branded content or things like that. So or is that, I don't know, like if you talk about like your day to day, like you got these big projects you want to do for features, and then you have like other documentaries that you're kind of doing as a company. How do you find all this work and prioritizing what you want to work on?
Well, I think it's something like Rodents was great. I mean, it's always nice to have kind of a longer term project where you really want to let things play out and see how so you can go shoot some, be editing. And then, you know, when the bigger paying work comes along, then you're kind of available for that. So I think, you know, sometimes it's a lot of juggling schedules, but I really like being able to, you know, you have this longer project, but those can get really, you know, that's a marathon, you know, so it's nice to have these other things that not only are good at paying the bills, and whether that's just freelance, you know, we all do different freelance work as well. So it's, but then, you know, you get a project done really quick and that's satisfying. And maybe that leads you to something else.
Yeah.
It puts you in a kind of a different mindset. You know, it's kind of like you're able to try out new tools, whether it be equipment or even situations, or sometimes you wind up in situations where you're pitched ideas and you're like, oh, well, that might be an interesting idea. I mean, all three of us wind up producing different projects freelance wise. And then Jeff is a cinematographer based out of New York and San Francisco, and Quinn's based out of San Francisco and edits and produces. And so, you know, we work on other people's documentaries. And so, I think the thing that we've all found is that these independent projects that we do, like Rodents of Unusual Size, are passion projects. You know, it's like you're doing it because you have this itch that you need to scratch. But with the success of these projects that, you know, when your films get reviewed and, you know, you know, national newspapers or on TV or NPR and stuff. That kind of gives us, raises awareness. And so I know that when we've been in meetings pitching with clients and stuff, it's like they want to hire the award-winning documentary filmmakers, you know, and they're willing to pay for that. And so that wasn't ever the intention of making these films, you know, but it's kind of a nice side project. And so, you know, we've been lucky enough that the films that we've made have been kind of, you know, both popular with audiences, but that a certain type of film reviewer, you know, enjoys them. I mean, you know, I think this last year somebody at ITVS wrote to us and they're like, hey, do you know what? You know, Rodents is like number 90 on the list of top 100 documentaries of all time. And you're like, what the hell? You know, okay. You know, and so that, you know, that obviously makes you feel good. But when it allows you to kind of create other opportunities, you know, the Heath project that Quinn and I and Jeff worked on together, we work with KCT, a public media station in Los Angeles, and they liked what we'd done before for them. And they said, hey, do you want to make this documentary about this Bay Area ceramicist? And we're like, we know nothing about Edith Heath. and I think Quinn knew a little bit more. And we said, okay, well, those projects are a little bit different because there's always time restrictions, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you're just like, okay, how do you, I think, Quinn, did we make that movie in like 5 months or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, and then we did another KCT hour-long piece. So it's funny, like, when you can bust out an hour in a few months and then you spend 4 years working on one that's, like, 70 minutes, you know? So, yeah. But it's also just, like, you know, so I think there's a lot of, like, you learn a lot of discipline of, like, getting things done. And maybe you can. But, you know, what's great about something like the Rodents Project is just being able to explore all these different avenues. Like you said, there's tons of stuff on the cutting room floor that, you know, never made it. But, you know, we would go to this country Mardi Gras and it's like, will this footage make it in? And there was a time where I was just like, there's no way this is going to get there. And then you figure out a way to make it work. So I think it's nice to get the thing done with a deadline, but it's also nice to kind of be open to whatever comes your way. And when you have 4 years in Louisiana, that's, you know, a lot of interesting things come your way.
Nice. Yeah, I don't think that Rodents would have been quite nearly the same experience if somebody was like, okay, you need to, here's a budget and then here's your timeline. And, you know, it didn't work that way. We weren't being paid. You know what I mean? Like, we were kind of there taking the ride as it came and kind of showing, saying yes a lot, you know, to things. And then, you know, that's that kind of a movie that it turned into, is just like, this is just what it felt like to kind of be there for that amount of time.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice with, you know, like with Rodents, it's like the only people that we're responsible to is to the three of us, you know, what's the sort of film that we want to make, you know, and, you know, there's parts of all three of us in there that we're all in unison. And there's other things that's like, oh, this is a Jeff thing. This is a Quinn thing. This is a Chris thing, you know, and it's kind of a mosaic of things. And it's, you know, that's the film. That's the sort of film that we wanted to make. And so, you know, we have audience, you know, ideas for marketing or the audience that we want to do. But really, we want people just to kind of check it out and in the end say, well, that was an interesting ride. And sometimes there's some people that are a little bit more vocal about it. And those are the people that kind of help spread the word about, you know, the awareness of this film being out there, you know.
Who was responsible for the name? Which of you came up with the name for the film?
Quinn.
Oh, yeah. That's a Quinn thing. Nice. It's funny. That was like the working title from the very, very beginning. And then it just kind of stuck. And then the people at ITVS PBS were just like, no, you can't change it. It's like, that's definitely staying. So.
And people started coming when we were, you know, doing film festivals and stuff. People would come dressed as Princess Bride characters to screenings and stuff like that. It tapped into kind of a print, you know, people of a certain age, like, yeah, hold that film in a very deep, you know, sacred place in their psyche.
Nice.
And yeah, while I wasn't able to be there, Quinn was able. We went to this cool, the film screen at this cool film festival, the Sleeping Giant Film Festival in Jacksonville, and they procured Nutria meat and like made Nutria chili fries and Nutria chili hot dogs at the concession stand, right?
Yeah, yeah, they did. It's this wonderful little kind of art house theater in the middle of Jacksonville, which I never, you know, thought of as like having this film community, but people are so dedicated to this little theater. And it's because they do stuff like that, you know what I mean? Where they're like, we're not only going to bring you this film that's, you know, this small little documentary that's touring around, but we're going to cook you the food. And it reminded me of the first time I was like saw a Les Blank film. It was at the Red Vic. It was his film Always for Pleasure about New Orleans. And he cooked jambalaya and brought it and we all ate. And it was like this, kind of like John Waters, this like sensory experience of seeing a film where you're smelling it, you're eating it, you're just kind of there for the whole experience. And like, that was, you know, definitely something I'll remember. Long live the Red Vic.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, do you often get to tour with these films in the first Dissonance? Did you guys have any touring for screenings?
Yeah. Yeah. For all of them, that we made that a big, I mean, just being a independent documentary, it just helps. Like, I mean, first doing festivals, but then, you know, doing a theatrical tour, and we would kind of break up the country in different little sprints of different areas and do the Q&As and everything like that. So it's always kind of interesting to meet the people and hear what they have to say about it. So
awesome.
Yeah, it was something that I think when we first made the film, it wasn't part of our plan, you know? But then as we started getting a chance to travel to different film festivals, you know, this is a time when film festivals could like fly you out and, you know, take you to these different places. Both Jeff and I and, you know, and Larry Quinlan, it's like, we all really like to travel, you know? So it's like, if you have an opportunity to travel, you say yes. And even if it's a place that you never knew that you would want to go to. But one of the things Jeff and I realized very early on is that while we thought we had the coolest film in the world, Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea, that people would appreciate, you know, we realized that like offbeat documentaries, while they're some of the more popular documentaries, there aren't a lot of opportunities for them. And so we needed to kind of go out there and roadshow the film to show that there was an audience for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we worked really hard in getting it out there, you know, harder than I think we ever wanted, because we didn't want this film to die on the vine. We saw that it was an opportunity. And so, you know, it's kind of turned into a cult documentary since then. But at the time, we were just like, we had spent 3.5 years making this film. We don't want it just to kind of disappear from the ether. But through that process, obviously, not only did we make a more successful film, but we also just had a more successful life and enjoying and being at all these kind of out of the way places. And so it's always become a part of all the films that we've distributed, because we recognize that it built the infrastructure for a successful film, because you have these kind of devoted fans. So like, it's kind of like a band, you know, you start playing the clubs. And so like the big people that saw you, the clubs, they're the people that are going to get you, you know, are going to show up and bring their 10 friends when they play the Warfield or whatever. And so a lot of this was just kind of learning on the job, and, you know, we wound up enjoying it. So, it was fun. And I think the Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea screened at like 250 film festivals around the world. And we opened like in about 100 cities, something like that.
I mean, and a lot of that is definitely Chris promoting that and getting the word out there. And, you know, and it just, I think down the road is like getting reviews and getting things like that just helps. But it's, yeah, just like being a touring band. It's just like you be out there, and being able to do a Q&A is going to be a lot more appealing to an independent theater owner than just like showing a film. So I think, you know, by doing a lot of legwork, you can really get it out there a lot more.
Great, great. Well, hey, everyone, watch these films. They're all great films. You got Rodents of Unusual Size, Everyday Sunshine, and Plagues and Pleasures on the Salton Sea. Jeff, Chris, Quinn, thanks so much for joining us here on SupDoc.
Thank you so much for having us.
We love your show, so thanks for having us, and keep on doing the great work you do.
Totally. Yeah, big fan, so really appreciate it.
Oh yeah, awesome! Thanks so much. I'd love to talk to you about like the doc SF Doc Fest at some point too. But I think we really really hit the limit on this so far. It's a pretty long interview, but covered a lot of ground.
Okay,
a lot of ground.
All right, so we'll trim it down however you want.
Good.
Thanks. So much, well, hopefully we'll have some real life screenings at some point in time, and we'll get a chance to connect. At some point. So
for sure. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a great day, guys. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com, recapping reality since 2015. Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scoville. Our associate producer is Nick Coltis. Please donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help us in other ways, please share the show with a friend. Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all of those platforms. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can find Paco and George's comedy gigs, when those are happening again, on the About Us page on the site. And SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans, so if you want to advertise, got a film, or opinions you want to share, just hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.